Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, and it's time for our news roundup. There have been increasing signs that this year, Election Day will likely stretch into Election Week or even Election Month. President Trump did nothing to quell those anxieties this week when he refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power in front of a room full of reporters.
Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
People are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
Democrats, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, immediately leapt on the comments.
You are not in North Korea. You are not in Turkey. You are not in Russia, Mr. President. And by the way, you are not in Saudi Arabia. You are in the United States of America. It is a democracy.
Tensions are boiling in the United States as the coronavirus death toll crosses 200,000 and protests over police violence reach a fever pitch in the wake of a grand jury decision in the Breonna Taylor case. Here to shed some light in the middle of all this heat is Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent. Anita, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Also with us, Devlin Barrett. He covers the FBI and the Department of Justice for The Washington Post. He's also the author of October Surprise, How the FBI Tried to Save Itself and Crashed an Election. Devlin, welcome. So let's start with the grim milestone the United States hit on Tuesday, 200,000 deaths from COVID-19. And the number of daily new cases countrywide is rising. It's been going up for the last 2 weeks, reversing a downward trend that goes back to mid-July. Anita, give us a quick snapshot of the country's status as of this past week.
Well, the coronavirus continues on, even though people are starting to talk about other things. We did hit 200,000, and actually in several states, many states, the infection rate is still going up. And, you know, as the country braces for phase two over, you know, in this winter time. So, you know, things continue even as people are getting out and going out. And that's part of the reason it's continuing, right? People aren't doing what federal officials and public health officials are telling them. And so the number keeps going up.
Well, and early this week, the CDC found itself in a scandal after it removed information from its website. An update last Friday provided more information about the risk of airborne transmission, specifically indoors. But on Monday, the update was removed. Anita, what's going on here?
Well, this is the same thing that we've seen now several times over the last several months. With the CDC, where they have essentially changed their mind or gotten some influence causing them to change what they're doing. They've done this with schools. They've done this periodically with other things about who should be tested. You know, the department says, the CDC says, nothing has changed, that they're learning things about this virus and they are updating as and telling the public as they know. But others are saying that the White House has influenced some of those decisions, and that's why they've changed things. Administration officials are telling us and telling other reporters that it's influenced by the White House, which very much wants to move on from this, wants people to get back to school, get back to work. And there's that influence. So things that generally didn't go to the White House for them to approve or look at are now being influenced by that.
Devlin, how does this add to the concern about how information is being shared with the public and adding to the public's lack of trust in the information that's being shared?
Well, it obviously creates doubt in everything. So even public official announcements are greeted with a higher level of skepticism. And, you know, some skepticism, I think, is probably good and helpful and productive in this process because there are unknowns as we go through. But what you're seeing is you're sort of seeing this sort of grinding politicization of all sorts of parts of the government You know, I think at one point it was the FBI, and now it's, you know, the very health professionals. And we've gotten to the post office now. Like, all these things are becoming these sort of political footballs, and it's making it harder and harder for the average person to really know what to trust.
Well, calls for CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield's resignation followed this week's scandal. Anita, are those calls likely to gain any traction?
You know, the White House and the president says that they are supportive of Dr. Redfield, but you're right. Those calls are from health officials. The morale is very low in the department. There are a lot of people that think that he isn't fighting back against this politicization the way he should. So, you know, at the moment, we don't hear anything from the White House, but I will caution there are times that have nothing to do with coronavirus about any number of staffers around the administration where one day they're in favor and the next day they're not. So it really does depend on how things continue to go, what Dr. Redfield says publicly. As you've seen over and over, President Trump has criticized public health officials, including him, when those officials say things that the president doesn't like. So really, it's an everyday thing. We have to watch how that relationship goes.
Well, and just remind us, Anita, how states use information disseminated by the CDC as they're making decisions about how to approach the control of the spread of coronavirus in their states.
Yeah, I mean, early on, the president made this decision that he would sort of delegate to the states what to do. Now, some people would say that he just can't have certain mandates at the federal level. The states really do need to decide on these things. So, but regardless, the president said early on, it's up to these individual states to decide what to do. But they are getting that health information from the federal government, from these scientists. So they're very much looking at these guidelines. What should we do? What benchmarks should we use to reopen, to go to these different phases, phase one, phase two in these states? So, you know, it's not a mandate, but the states are very much looking for health information from the federal government about how to move forward.
Well, let's bring another voice into the conversation. Fernando Pizarro is a Washington-based political reporter and a journalism professor at American University. Fernando, it's always great to have you with us.
Hi, Jen. Happy to be back.
Well, the FDA found itself in the crosshairs of President Trump this week after it announced a plan to issue tougher standards for emergency approval of a coronavirus vaccine. The president responded to a reporter's question on Wednesday.
Well, I tell you what, we're looking at that. That has to be approved by the White House. We may or may not approve it. That sounds like a political move, because when you have Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, these great companies coming up with the vaccines, and they've done testing and everything else, I'm saying, why would they have to be, you know, adding great length to the process?
Fernando, what are the tougher standards the FDA is looking to put in place, and why?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration is going to tell vaccine manufacturers that they need to wait at least 2 months to give volunteers, people who are participating in clinical trials, the second dose of a possible vaccine before they can get what the government calls an emergency use authorization, which is the mechanism that these companies need to make the vaccine widely available. Now, the Food and Drug Administration will issue these new standards for this emergency approval for the vaccine, but the White House now is attacking that as a political move. Many people, as polls show, think that the administration is using the early assumption, especially pushed by the president, that a vaccine may be ready by November 3rd, that is, by the election, and that this obviously goes, these new regulations probably would push the approval of the vaccine in the United States way past Election Day, maybe not even in November, and that's not exactly what the president is being talking about, as suggesting publicly all the time that the vaccine will be ready before that.
Well, and Devlin, this comes amid increasing concerns about the politicization of the vaccine approval process. What, if anything, is the FDA doing to ease those concerns?
Well, I think what they're trying to assure people is that they are not going to recommend something that's not safe. But I think at the same time, you have people, particularly among skeptics of the president, who are saying, look, there's clearly some pressure being exerted on these agencies to make things look and sound better than they probably are. So how do we trust these agencies? How do we, if the agencies say it's to trust us, is that something we should do? And, you know, obviously there are a lot of folks who are senior health officials in the government who are trying to assure the public, we are going to do this the right way, we promise. But the more this stuff gets argued about and the more that you see these back and forths, it becomes harder to just take them at their word.
Well, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, went head-to-head with Republican Senator Rand Paul at a committee hearing on Wednesday. Dr. Fauci explained that New York's low coronavirus numbers were a result of citizens following CDC guidelines to lower risk. Then Senator Paul fired back.
Or they've developed enough community immunity right. that they're no longer having the pandemic because they have enough immunity in New York City to actually stop.
I challenge that, Senator.
I'm afraid, please, sir,
I would like to be able to do this because this happens with Senator Rand all the time. You were not listening to what the director of the CDC said, that in New York it's about 22%. If you believe 22% is herd immunity, I believe you're alone in that.
20 seconds here, Anita. Briefly, this points again to this tension between what public health experts are saying and some elected officials are saying about how to slow spread of the coronavirus.
Right. The herd immunity just basically means a number of people are immune to because of the vaccine or mass infection. But Dr. Fauci is saying that's not true. There are not enough mass infections there to be herd immunity.
Well, Max on Twitter says Trump's claim that there won't be a peaceful transfer of power, but a continuation, as long as we don't count all the ballots, is the stuff of dictatorship. Didn't we just condemn the same thing in Belarus? We're talking about the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HelloFresh. Get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your door with the meal kit delivery service HelloFresh. Make home cooking fun, easy, and affordable. There's something for everyone, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes. Go to HelloFresh.com/1A80 and use code 1A80 to get a total of $80 off, including free shipping on the first box. Additional restrictions apply.
Activist Aaron Dorr tells his flock of pro-gun followers on Facebook that he's tirelessly fighting for their Second Amendment rights. But if that's true, why do so many pro-gun Republicans hate him so much?
Aaron Dorr is a scam artist, a liar, and he is doing Iowans no services and no favors.
Find out on the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White, and it's the News Roundup on 1A. We're talking about the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter. After 2 days of honors at the Supreme Court, on Friday, late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg became the first woman and first Jewish person ever to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Anita, why hasn't a woman ever held this honor before?
That's a great question. You know, they've been doing this tradition since 1852, and it hasn't been as many people as you might think. It's been about 35, so a lot of presidents, other people. But mostly, or obviously, this is always for someone who serves in the government. Four civilians have also been honored, but it's not called lying in state. So Congress decides who does this, and you know, obviously many elected officials in this country until more recently were men.
Well, Devlin, before the Capitol, Justice Ginsburg lay in repose at the Supreme Court. Can you describe what this remembrance was like and who came to pay their respects?
Well, pretty much the entire city came to respects, and it was an interesting mix because it began as sort of a spontaneous demonstration of support and remembrance that the very night of her death outside the Supreme Court. And then obviously it morphed into the official pageantry of remembrance. And, you know, I think the video that is probably going to be most lasting from that is people chanting against the president when he showed up. You know, I think it says something about the state of our politics right now that even in, you know, a memorial setting, that the political anger is so great that people are going to essentially boo the president in public. And that just tells you what the stakes are, of that, you know, her death is obviously sad and obviously a moment in history. but it's also another, you know, another front in this political battle that we're following.
Well, there's a looming battle in the Senate over who will replace Justice Ginsburg on the bench. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell appears to have enough support to vote on whoever President Trump nominates this weekend. The president saying he'll make that announcement on Saturday. Anita, right now we note two Republican senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, have said they think the nomination process should wait until after the election in November. First, a distinction here, after the election, not after the inauguration if a new president is elected. And that's an important distinction to make.
Right. They basically want to see who wins the presidency. That president, they're saying, should decide what comes next. You know, that is a distinction. There's a lot of people back and forth about whether this should, you know, even on the Republican side, whether the hearing should be before the election, it should be after. But overall, it does look like the Republicans, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, does have the numbers. Only these two people have said that they are opposed.
And how firm are Collins and Murkowski in their stance?
Well, they seem firm. I mean, you know, what's going to happen starting next week after this announcement is that the White House is going to have this woman, it is going to be a woman, come around to Senate offices. And we'll get a good idea then about whether Democrats and these two Republicans are willing to meet with this person, right? Because if you'll remember, 4 years ago, when Barack Obama nominated someone that did not go through, Merrick Garland, Republicans didn't even meet with him. And they said, what's the point of having this meeting? We know we're not going to vote on this. So that's going to tell us something. That's going to give us a signal about what's going to happen. But I will note that there are other critics of the president. There are other people that we thought might take the same stance and say, let's hold off. I point to Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, who, you know, has gone back and forth with the president on a variety of issues. He actually said, let's let this go forward. So I think that people were really looking at him to say, is he going to be, you know, I think they'd still even need more, one more person. But people were really looking to see if he would say yes or no. And everybody else has said they want to go forward on the Republican side.
At this point, what's the likelihood of other Republican senators changing their position?
I think it's really unlikely. The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, feels very strongly that he has those votes to go forward. Now, look, a couple things can happen. You know, we'll see when all this happens. We see the announcement on Saturday, but we'll have to see what the vetting comes up with and what those hearings look like. But they've already looked at the calendar. They're looking at the week that they want to have the hearings, the week that they want to have the vote. So clearly, the president and Senator McConnell think they can push this through. They feel good about those numbers.
Devlin, what options do Democrats have on the table at this point to try to delay this confirmation?
Convert a Republican or two. You know, this is really, you know, the Democrats can make as much of a as much noise as possible, and they can do sort of performative things and argumentative things. But the magic number here is four, that the Republicans basically, if the Democrats want to stop this from happening, the Democrats need to peel off four Republican senators to their argument here. And so far, as Anita points out, they really only have two. And the other thing to remember is while there are Republicans who are disenchanted, let's say, with the president, the issue of judges is one on which the Republican Party is very unified and very committed. You know, Mitt Romney may dislike President Trump, but Mitt Romney likes conservative judges. So I think it's going to take something like a political miracle for the Democrats to peel off those other two senators. But, you know, no one can predict the future, so we'll have to see how it plays out.
Well, as we said, President Trump is expected to announce his Supreme Court pick Saturday evening, and most court observers say Judge Amy Coney Barrett of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is the overwhelming favorite. Fernando, let's just start with the background. Who is Amy Coney Barrett?
Well, she is a longtime favorite among conservatives. She's 48 years old. She went to Notre Dame University Law School. She was a professor there. She is now a judge in Chicago at the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. She has had for a long time a very conservative positions on particularly she's on abortion rights. She's very pro-life. She's had decisions on gun rights. She's had a very conservative approach to interpret Constitution. Many people say that she is very much like the late Justice Antonin Scalia as what it's called, an originalist, and somebody who likes to interpret legally the original intention of the framers of the Constitution. She's also Catholic. And even though she has not ruled directly on abortion rights as a judge, many say that she has, she would be maybe a possible justice who could rule against Roe versus Wade.
Well, in 2016, Barrett suggested a conservative-leaning Supreme Court would leave in place the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision on abortion, but give states more leeway to impose restriction. And this is her speaking at Jacksonville University at the time.
I don't think the core case, the Roe's core holding that, you know, women have a right to an abortion, I don't think that would change. But I think the question of whether people can get very late-term abortions, you know, how many restrictions can be put on clinics, I think that would change.
Anita, your thoughts. I mean, Barrett said that before Trump was elected. Do you think there will be a push for an outright reversal of Roe v. Wade with a 6-3 conservative court?
I do think there will be a push. There are many people that are looking for that. I would just say that she said that, as you said, before President Trump and before this court changed. You know, it was most recently 5-4 on the conservative side. And then obviously with the death of Justice Ginsburg, now we're at 3 on that liberal side. So, you know, she would make that 6 if she was on there, whoever the president puts in, if they get confirmed. So I do think there's going to be a push. There are a lot of people on the conservative side, on the Republican side, that want her merely for this and other issues. So I think there would be a push. The question of whether that would go through or not.
Devlin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I also think, you know, this would be if Barrett or someone like her gets on the bench, that would be a major shift in the power balance on the court, obviously. And I think everyone involved sort of realizes the stakes. You know, she's also signaled through her relatively short judicial career that she's very pro-gun rights. So that would be another area where I think you could see a significant amount of shift in terms of Supreme Court decisions. And look, I think the stakes are incredibly high for the Supreme Court, in part because so many issues are now, so many policy decisions are now practically being made by the court, including, Obamacare and a bunch of others.
Let's talk about what happens as we move farther along in this process. If President Trump is able to add his nominee to the Supreme Court, Fernando, do Democrats, are they truly considering trying to add more justices to the court?
That's been something that's been mentioned several times. I believe Vice President Joe Biden has decided not to want to get into this. He was addressed and he was asked the very same question at some point, but he said he didn't want to get into this because then it would become a political point in the campaign. But yes, there are some Democrats that see this as a reason to expand the Supreme Court because they feel that if Trump gets a nominee through this year, even before or after the election, but before the new Congress and the new president and takes over next year, then they would have the chance to to take, as Devlin was saying, to make change the balance of the court significantly.
Anita, your thoughts? What are you hearing from Democratic lawmakers, if anything, about the seriousness of this consideration?
You know, I think they are serious, but I think it really depends on a couple things. One, obviously, who wins the White House. And if, it is a President Joe Biden and he's not supportive, that's not going to go anywhere. Also depends on who wins the Senate. You know, we don't know what that's going to look like. We'll have to see in November. But I think there are a lot of considerations. It's not just, enlarging the Supreme Court. I saw today a progressive House member is introducing a bill that would limit the number of years on the Supreme Court. So you could serve 18 years. So I think there are a number of things that Democrats would look towards, but they really need to see what happens in November.
Well, another case that's going to come before the Supreme Court is a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. The hearing is scheduled to take place 1 week after the election. Fernando, what's at stake with this Obamacare hearing in November?
Well, on November 10th, the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear another case on the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, whether the Trump administration and 18 Republican states that have pushed this this lawsuit feel that the whole law, Obamacare, has to go because there's no more individual mandate. Let's remember, Congress changed and eliminated the individual mandate penalty for people who didn't have health insurance, which was an important, essential part of the Affordable Care Act. So now they feel that if this doesn't, if this is not there, the Supreme Court has to decide to eliminate the whole and bring down the whole law down with a decision. Many Democratic leaning states, their counter lawsuit is that their counterpoint is that this would leave out about 20 million people without health insurance. And then now let's remember that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was part of the last two major decisions in 2012 and in 2015 that basically consolidated the ACA after the cases that were brought before the Supreme Court.
Well, Devlin, voting has already started in some parts of the country. How much of an impact is this Supreme Court vacancy having on voters and swaying their decision in one way or another, or getting just more people out to vote because of this open seat?
So the conventional wisdom on voters and the Supreme Court is that it motivates Republican voters very much, and it tends not to motivate Democratic voters as much. I think what you're seeing at the first blush is some indications that more Democrats may be more energized and more motivated precisely because of the Supreme Court issue. But I think the data is a little soon to really know for sure, I guess is the way I would put it. The other argument, frankly, is that Democrats are plenty motivated already. They don't need any extra reasons to vote this year. So I do think it adds to the stakes. It adds to the motivation on both sides. But I also think, you know, if you look at the traditional voters for both parties, they're already sort of running at 11 as it is. So I think, you know, if they get to 12 or 13, you know, that's interesting, but it may not affect a great deal.
And briefly, Anita, how has this shifted the Biden campaign strategy, if at all?
Oh, I think it has shifted. They're really pushing on this. They've been talking about coronavirus, and now they're starting to talk about this. And they're really saying, look at what's at stake here. We mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and they're saying, look, healthcare is on the line. It's not the only thing, though.
We're rounding up the week's top headlines with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based Politico reporter. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who specialize in issues such as isolation, depression, stress, anxiety, and more. Connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment when you need professional help. Get help at your own time and your own pace. Schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. Visit betterhelp.com/1A to learn more and get 10% off your first month.
With the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the president is hoping to fill the seat with a conservative judge.
And evangelicals who play an important part in American politics have been waiting for this moment.
But how did evangelicals become such a powerful force?
Listen now to the history of evangelicals on the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to the Friday news roundup with Politico's Anita Kumar, Devlin Barrett of The Washington Post, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based Politico reporter. Well, President Trump justified his decision to rush a Supreme Court confirmation this week. He says the court could be crucial in deciding the outcome of the election.
I think it's very important. I think this will end up in the Supreme Court. And I think it's very important that we have 9 justices. And I think the system is going to go very quickly. I'll be submitting at 5 o'clock on Saturday the name of the person I chose for this most important of all positions.
Anita, The Atlantic published a story this week outlining how President Trump could subvert the results of this election if he loses. How would seating a 9th Supreme Court justice help him in this effort?
Well, there are cases, you know, there are a couple things. There are cases right now that are going to the Supreme Court in individual states. I'd point to Pennsylvania that had a ruling about when ballots could come in and be counted, what that deadline is. That's being appealed, so it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now, obviously, they're missing a justice, so it could impact that. But the president's been pretty clear that he is planning on probably contesting some of these states' results and quickly litigating that. So if they go quickly through the court system and they could end up at the Supreme Court, and he would like 9 justices there to make those decisions. You know, it really depends on what happens, how close these individual states are. But the Trump campaign is targeting 17 states. They feel like many of them could be very, very close, like they were in 2016. So they've all indications are that they plan on contesting and in the court system.
Would there be any expectation that that presumed ninth justice would recuse herself because she's just been appointed by President Trump?
Well, I think that how the Supreme Court works is if you're not present for those oral arguments of a particular case, or you're not present when that case starts, then you sit it out. But generally, I don't think so. You know, obviously, there's 2 other justices on the Supreme Court that the president appointed that are going to deal with, that have dealt with and are dealing with several things that have come straight out of the administration. Even his tax returns and financial records, and both of the justices he appointed, nominated, and then got confirmed, dealt with that case.
Well, the president, again, refused to commit to a peaceful transition of power, saying, get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly, there will be a continuation. That's a direct quote from President Trump. But we got this email from Stan who says, why do we spend time talking about the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transition of power? Don't we understand that this is the president's latest head fake, a rerun of his the elections rigged episode from fall 2016, a distraction from his pathetic performance in this season's COVID-19 plotline, just stop. Devlin, what do you make of what Stan says there, that this is just a distraction?
Well, look, I think there's 2 things going on, right? One is a very, I think, fair and legitimate debate about what is the safest and best way to conduct an election during a pandemic. And 2, you know, I do think that part, to Stan's point, I think part of the challenge here is how do you discuss these things rationally and calmly without getting into hysterics when the president loves to just, you know, take a flamethrower to every discussion. And so, you know, it becomes very difficult to have a conversation about, you know, even small issues of voting irregularities when the White House, you know, trumpets, as they did yesterday, you know, a case that involved apparently 9 ballots in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. You know, these are not the issues on which the Republic will probably rise or fall. But sometimes we debate them as if they are. And so I think it's worthwhile to sort of always have a measure of calm in how you discuss these hypotheticals and, you know, see what actually happens versus what you're afraid of happening.
Well, Anita, as someone who covers the White House, I'm really curious to hear your perspective here.
I hear this over and over again. I mean, it's a good argument. There are so many people like this caller who think it's all a distraction, and particularly right now that it's a distraction from the coronavirus response of this administration. But, you know, I think over and over again, I've seen the last 4 years that many times things that the president kind of just says, some of those things, you're right, he doesn't come back to, he doesn't follow through on, but a number of them he does. And so I think that people, Democrats and his opponents, really do take these seriously because they don't know what's going to happen. And they worry that in 5 weeks or whenever this is in the election, that he will fight that and they want to be prepared for that. So I see both sides of it. It really depends on what it is and what you believe the president will do on that particular topic.
Well, lawmakers have reacted since the president made those remarks. Here's Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont speaking on Thursday.
Let me make this clear to Donald Trump. Too many people have fought and died to defend American democracy, and you are not going to destroy it. The American people will not allow that to happen.
Fernando, what have we heard from Republican lawmakers? What have they said about the president's refusal to commit to a peaceful transition of power?
Well, here we've seen a more clear and reaction, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who issued a statement. He even told Fox News that the winner of the November 3rd election will be inaugurated January 20th. So the same has come from other Republican lawmakers. Mitt Romney went even further. He compared it to Belarus. He said that this would seem like protesters are complaining about the re-election of the president Alexander Lukashenko, which seems to be maybe have some issues there. And he felt that that all these statements from the president are unthinkable and unacceptable. And I wanted to add something as a reaction to what Anita and Devlin were saying. About that caller as well. I think presidential words do matter. As someone who grew up abroad under a regime that was very far from being democratic, when a president of the United States, in this case, something that is not something we see all the time, questions the legality of a ballot, so questions the democratic process, it is more than just a distraction. I think his words have an impact on many people, whether they are just empty threats. They are presidential words and statements that are putting the whole democratic process in the U.S. in question.
Well, and Anita, when you have the president saying, get rid of the ballots out loud, and we're at a time in this country where Americans have a fundamental distrust in the institutions that are supposed to serve us, is there something deeper at work here that we should be really concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at polls, people are saying they don't know if their vote's going to count. They are worried about that. They're worried about the post office. You know, they hear what the president says. I think Fernando's exactly right on this. Words do matter. He is the most powerful person in this country. What the president of the United States says matters, whether he follows through on it or not. So there is that. You know, we're so used to this president sort of shattering the norms on so many different levels. Sometimes it is that language. Why is he saying this? I mean, does he really think that your election, your vote doesn't matter? That's really of concern to a lot of people.
Well, we got this email from Andrew who says, I keep hearing about the peaceful transfer of power after the election for the office of the president. I'm wondering what a non-peaceful transfer of power would play out in the U.S. Would we just not have an executive branch? If there's no executive branch, are we reliant on Congress? Anita, that's a great question.
It is a great question. It's actually something I've been reporting on this week. There are so many different avenues this could go down. I don't think that anyone thinks that the president or anyone else was referring to non-peaceful in terms of war or battles or anything like that. I do think that there could be a lot of lawsuits and litigation. I think state legislatures could get involved. I think the U.S. Congress could even get involved. I mean, this is a very remote possibility that legislatures and the House would be involved, but there's actually a path for that to happen. So I think fighting until the last day, until January, when we figure out who this is what people mean by that, as opposed to what we've seen in the past, which is when people are voted out of office, they work with the new administration in all those different agencies to help them understand what they're going to have to know, take this massive undertaking of the U.S. government and have a smooth transition.
Devlin, I want you to maybe pull the curtain back a little bit for us and share a bit about the conversations you're having in your newsroom about what election coverage looks like November 3rd and beyond, because the likelihood of us having a decision on November 3rd is a bit shaky.
Right. I think, you know, the standard expectation is you would normally know late in the evening or, you know, very early morning hours who the winner was and who the loser was. No one can guarantee that. And I think there's some good reason to think that it will take longer than that this time. I think as reporters, what we're talking about is, okay, it may be tense, but we're going to have to just, you know, for one, be on our toes. And two, you know, I think a lot of what we talk about as reporters is, you know, make sure that we're not falling for any disinformation. One of the things when you talk to the U.S. intelligence officials who deal with election interference is they're most concerned in some ways about the period after Election Day. If it is in question, what kinds of fake false things might be pumped out on the internet to confuse and upset Americans and make them, you know, distrust whatever the outcome ends up being. So I think, you know, what I think of it as sort of, you know, the deep breath lesson, which is you're going to have to work through it and you're going to have to figure out and make sure and double check that every single piece of information you're getting is correct.
Well, switching gears a bit, on Wednesday, a Kentucky grand jury announced felony endangerment charges against one former Louisville police officer for his part in the raid on Breonna Taylor's apartment in March, where she was shot and killed by police. The jury did not bring charges against the other officers involved, nor did they charge anyone with killing Breonna Taylor. Here's Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron speaking to the press about the decision.
Criminal homicide encompasses the taking of a life by another. While there are six possible homicide charges under Kentucky law, these charges are not applicable to the facts before us because our investigation showed and the grand jury agreed that Mattingly and Cosgrove were justified in their return of deadly fire after having been fired upon by Kenneth Walker.
Fernando, give us more details on the grand jury's decision.
It's interesting to add, Jan, that the Kentucky Attorney General, who is an African-American and a Republican, when he announced his grand jury decision, said that he understood that there would be pain and that he understood that not everyone would be satisfied. The issue with this is that we have to look back at the case. They found that there were 32 shots fired. Officers shot her six times, and as you mentioned, they are facing no charges. And former Louisville detective Brett Hankinson, who did not shoot Breonna Taylor, as I believe you mentioned, he was charged with reckless endangerment for firing into the neighbor's apartment. Her boyfriend at the time did shoot back at the police officers, but he had also made a call believing that intruders were getting into the apartment. The whole issue here is that the police officers keep on saying that they did make a verbal warning that they were coming in, but many other neighbors feel that warning was not properly heard. So that's been one of the issues at hand here about what kind of warning the police officers gave. Again, also the sheer amount of firepower that came down on this apartment is just unbelievable.
And I just want to be clear, Officer Brett Hankinson was charged with three counts of wanton endangerment. You know, Anita, I think it's interesting to note that Attorney General Cameron, as Fernando said, a Republican, spoke at the Republican National Convention last month, and he talked about the importance of law and order. He referenced Breonna Taylor's death, but this has been going on for months now, and I wonder if that decision on his part has further politicized this.
You know, definitely. I've seen criticism. There are a lot of people that are criticizing this decision not to charge in her death, and a lot of people are saying it's because he's Republican. It's because he's close to Senator Mitch McConnell. It's because he's close to President Trump. And you saw the president praise him for this decision, and you know that only takes it a step further. And so I do think everything is political now, and this is definitely one of those things.
Well, Devlin, protesters took to the streets in hours after the decision. Two Louisville police officers were shot, and a suspect in that shooting is now in custody. Quickly bring us up to speed on the officers who were shot and what we know about the suspect.
So we don't know a ton about the suspect at this point, but we know the officers are expected to survive. They're not believed to be life-threatening injuries. But, you know, I think what's so awful, and I've covered law enforcement a long time, I think what's so awful about this current moment in America is the degree to which you're seeing a real breakdown in trust and faith between the citizens of cities and their police departments. And, you know, Louisville is the latest and most vivid example, but you're seeing this same dynamic play out in a lot of American cities right now.
But very and, briefly, I think yeah. Some people would say that breakdown has been ongoing for decades.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I think the fact that so many of these confrontations are now on video makes the debate much more unavoidable. I think frankly, in you know, when I started in the dark ages, you know, this kind of announcement would be done on a Friday afternoon. There'd be no video. There would be no there would just be the cop's words against the witness's words, and you know, people would be upset, but nothing would happen, and there wouldn't be this kind of critical mass of public debate about these issues. Now you're seeing a national debate about these issues, which is a huge shift.
That's Devlin Barrett. He covers the FBI and the Department of Justice for The Washington Post. Anita Kumar, Politico's White House correspondent, and Fernando Pizarro, a Washington-based political reporter and journalism professor at American University. Thanks to you both, for all of you, for joining us today. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for our international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from KBucksbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Jen White, and we still have plenty of the week's top stories to talk about in the international section of our news roundup. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un issues a rare personal apology for the killing of a South Korean official. Europe grapples with the second wave as COVID-19 cases spike. London's mayor says the city is at a tipping point. And the Kremlin hits back at Europe and the United States for refusing to recognize the now widely discredited president of Belarus. For the international news roundup this week, we're joined by Nick Schifrin, foreign affairs and defense correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Williams, a senior foreign editor for Vox. She's also the co-host of Worldly, Vox's foreign affairs podcast. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And David Rennie. He's the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, it's always great to have you.
Hello.
So even virtually, tensions between the U.S. and China flared at the annual U.N. General Assembly in New York on Tuesday, where President Trump said this during his speech.
As we pursue this bright future, we must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world, China.
The statement falls in line with Trump's past comments about China and coronavirus. In remarks released ahead of Tuesday, Chinese President Xi Jinping said this about the U.S., that, quote, no country has the right to dominate global affairs, control the destiny of others, or keep advantages in development all to itself, end quote. David, what is Trump continuing, or why, rather, is he continuing to point fingers at China about coronavirus, particularly in a week where the U.S. reached a milestone of 200,000 deaths?
There's two reasons. There's domestic politics, and clearly in this election in America, where the death toll is such a shock to many voters, blaming China and reminding voters that the virus began in China is simply good domestic politics. And that's certainly how China sees it. They say they're being scapegoated, despite the fact that they have done so much better, they say, at eliminating the virus effectively within China's borders. I think there is an element that President Trump really does blame China for, in his view, stealing the kind of economic boom that was going to deliver him an easy re-election. I have spoken to Americans with reason to kind of know the thinking inside the White House for my reporting, and they've made it very clear that in around late May, President Trump, who had hoped that things like the phase one trade deal where China was going to buy all those soybeans from places like Iowa full of grateful Trump voting farmers, that mood of his changed very dramatically when he basically decided that he should believe those around him telling him that China had either deliberately unleashed the virus, for which there is no evidence, I should say, or had at least very carelessly allowed travel to continue out of China. And that is, we saw this in President Trump's speech. He laid out this kind of charge that at a time when China was criticizing him for closing America's borders to many Chinese arrivals, China then promptly locked down its own borders very tight. And as ever, with some of the things that President Trump says about China. He's not wrong. I mean, China did play double standards with those border controls. This is a massive argument about controlling the narrative around COVID. China has convinced its own population that it has a lot to be proud of, that COVID is a big success for the Communist Party. That is a lot less popular as an opinion outside China, and President Trump is leading the charge.
Can you explain a bit more about Xi Jinping's comments about the U.S. dominating global affairs? Because that's an accusation that's been lobbed against China as well.
Sure. So this is a gigantic argument about whether China is the disruptive arrival in the international system and its assertive, aggressive diplomacy, its desire to have rules that don't bind its actions, make it a kind of wrecker of the global system. Or China's view is that Donald Trump is the saboteur, the wrecker of the international system, and that China is merely playing by the rules and is a positive builder of global peace. Xi Jinping told people that China is a defender of the international order. Now, the truth is that China likes rules that let China sell its goods overseas. It likes people having to open their markets to China. China doesn't always extend the same privileges itself, and China likes rules that suit China. It ignores rules that don't suit China. So it is quite a disruptive presence. But the problem is you have these two essentially very disruptive leaders, Xi Jinping and Donald Trump. And if you talk to people like the Europeans or some of China's neighbors in Asia, they frankly are pretty worried by both the Trump administration and China's role. And so they watch this dueling speeches at this virtual UN General Assembly with real dismay, because to them, there's this phrase you hear from Asian neighbors that when the elephants are fighting, the grass gets trampled. And if you're a neighbor, you don't like these kind of these mutual accusations, because it's really a great power contest that will not end well for China's neighbors.
Well, Jennifer, as David is explaining there, this is really a continuation of U.S.-China tensions. How would you characterize the relationship right now?
It's pretty bad. It's as bad as it's been, I would say, probably in decades. We're really seeing a breakdown in, you know, even the kind of most basic cooperation and kind of understanding of, you know, we need each other. We need each other for commerce, for trade, for foreign affairs, for lots of reasons on issues like North Korea, lots of other issues. You know, the U.S. and China kind of have traditionally kind of set aside some of their disagreements and said, let's work together. But part of this, you know, is a deliberate decision on the Trump administration's part and on President Trump's part to move away from a kind of previous model of thinking about China. So previous administrations, both Republican and Democrat to varying degrees, essentially had this conception that, you know, by working with China, by bringing it into the international community, by bringing it into the kind of, you know, international order and the rules framework, that it would help China essentially kind of open up and be more, you know, willing to play by the rules of you know, the international order that has very much benefited the U.S. We have not seen that actually happen, right? We have seen China very strategically and Xi Jinping in particular very cannily take advantage of a lot of these international institutions to further China's interests. And so the Trump administration has essentially decided to make a very clear policy change and said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to have this kind of assumption that by working closely with China, we can, you know, make China into this kind of responsible actor. And we're going to take a much more aggressive approach. And that's, you know, we're seeing the fruits of that right now.
Well, all told, the biggest headline from the UN this week was not the war of words we've been talking about, but a promise made to the UN General Assembly by President Xi Jinping. He said China would be carbon neutral by the year 2060, and he set a target to reach peak emissions by 2030. David, China's the world's biggest greenhouse gas emitter. Do we know how they're going to make this happen?
It's a huge development. So he said two things, one of which was not a huge surprise, that the carbon emissions that China gives off would peak in 2030. That was kind of what people were expecting. The really big surprise was he has been under pressure from behind the scenes by people like the European Union for some time now to commit himself to carbon neutrality, meaning that if you add up all of the CO2 emitted inside China and then you set it off against all of the CO2 absorbed by whether it's technological means or forests and trees, planting new trees, that comes to net zero. Now, the EU has promised to try and do that by 2050 under President Trump. The US is not making any such promises. We did not expect China to make any promise before the November elections in America, because China's view of climate change and how much it's willing to try is incredibly linked to its relationship with the United States, because China knows that America is also a gigantic emitter and a big competitor, and it doesn't want to be making economic sacrifices to save the planet if America isn't going to do the same. So we didn't expect Xi to move. There's a good explanation, I think, that one of the reasons he made this commitment to go carbon neutral by 2060 is that China's reputation among a lot of Western countries is in the gutter right now, because it's been very aggressive all year over a whole range of issues. And so this was a way of very, very kind of dramatically claiming the moral high ground. But it's going to take an extraordinary shift in the Chinese economy. No one has ever attempted such a gigantic shift in the energy mix or the way that people manufacture. It's going to mean that all electricity produced in China is going to have to be carbon zero carbon by 2060. At the moment, 60% of China's electricity still comes from coal, and they're still building enormous amounts of coal production, not only inside China, but also outside China. China is by far the largest financier of coal production and coal-fired power stations all around the world, in friendly countries in Africa and Asia. So people are very interested in this promise. They didn't expect it, but there are a lot of devils in the detail that need to be explored.
Well, Nick, it's important to know here President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. Is there a political component here as we head into our election season?
Well, all foreign policy of any country, I would argue, but certainly any foreign policy discussed in the 2 months before the presidential election in the United States is going to have a domestic politics angle. But I think David's right in identifying some of the politics in this case is with Europe. And how the EU threatened recently to impose carbon tariffs on China if China doesn't reduce emissions. Not clear that was a real threat, but to a certain extent, this is a relatively easy diplomatic win for China with Europe, at least the headline. And as David pointed out, you know, how do they actually enact it? We'll know more in the next couple months as China's next five-year plan is released. But the trends are more coal, not less coal. For China. And so the challenge will be, you know, whether China can expand on what has become the largest electric vehicle market in the world, the largest manufacturer of electric cars and buses. And that market has helped improve not only Chinese automotive companies, but also international ones. But it's just not clear how China can actually do this and whether they intend to do this or at least release the details of this in the near future.
I'm going to read you this tweet from Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. He posted earlier this morning. He says, quote, "Shocked and appalled, I just left a 90-minute classified briefing on foreign malign threats to our elections. From spying to sabotage, Americans need to see and hear these reports," end quote. Nick, I know you wanted to talk more about some of these intelligence briefings. What's going on?
Well, I think that as we all focus on the election and some of the headlines coming out of what President Trump is promising or not promising to do in the aftermath of that election, the disinformation campaigns, the attempts to influence, and the overall meddling that we saw in 2016 is repeating itself. They are. Those methods are repeating themselves. And what the intelligence community has tried to do so far, at least in the last couple of weeks, relatively low-key, is to warn the senators and the congresspeople who are on the intelligence communities that this is coming and some of the details therein. Top of the list, of course, is Russia. The intelligence community has been very clear that continuing to this day, Russians around the Kremlin, pro-Putin, are trying to tip the scale toward Trump. Number two is China, who for the first time, according to Facebook, launched some influence campaigns, but most of the intelligence community believes is on a more long-term effort to understand where President Biden would be, to understand what a second Trump term would be, and to do intelligence gathering. And Iran has targeted the Trump campaign and administration officials, so far as we know, unsuccessfully. But these really are ongoing. And yet, there is incredible controversy on the Hill because the Director of National Intelligence. Mr. Ratcliffe is declining to give full briefings to the House and Senate, and we see a real considerable effort across the administration to downgrade the threat by Russia and to upgrade the threat by China, even though it is Russia that is the short-term threat, every analyst I speak to says.
Well, and something you said there jumped out to me. You said that the intelligence community's efforts to inform Congress about what's happening, it's been relatively low-key. Can you explain that a bit more?
So we have seen attempts by the intelligence community to give public statements and to say explicitly that Russia is on the side of the president. And the president has not responded well to those. So earlier this year, there was a very important briefing about that. And the president was told about that briefing and essentially fired the then director of national intelligence, acting director of national intelligence, Joe McGuire. And so, you know, it's no secret that the president does not appreciate the idea of Russia being seen as aiding his campaign in 2020 or in 2016. And so what the intelligence officials I speak to say is they're trying their best within that context to either give classified briefings, so it's behind closed doors like the one that Senator Blumenthal mentions, or to provide public statements that list China first, but still give some evidence for what Russia is doing. And they really have given some evidence, including the names of some Russian officials who are trying to influence the election.
And Jennifer, what does this say to you about the way we should move into November and be perhaps more mindful of what's crossing our social media feeds?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think one thing we learned from the 2016 election is that, you know, social media is essentially a cesspool of disinformation. I think a lot of people knew that before the election, to be perfectly frank. But, you know, there's a very real kind of problem here. And something I've been discussing a lot with people I speak to in my reporting and work. And that's kind of the question of whether Russia even needs to bother this time around, because essentially, America's kind of doing its job for it in this regard, and in particular, President Trump, right? So a lot of the disinformation that Russia is trying to put forward, and that most analysts think, you know, we're going to see more of, in particular, in the days after the election, has to do with, you know, actually making the election seem illegitimate, or making people question the legitimacy of voting, whether their ballots are even going to count, whether the final tally is accurate. Well, we see that exact same language coming from Donald Trump every single day on Twitter, in press conferences, everywhere, talking about, you know, that vote by mail is a scam, even though there's zero evidence for that, et cetera. And so, you know, essentially, Russia, you know, in my opinion, if it were, I don't know, thinking more strategically, might save its money and use it elsewhere, because essentially, you know, Trump is helping. But it's also even kind of deeper, that the divisions, you know, societal kind of divisions and the political schisms and the partisanship and kind of just the real ugliness that is kind of defined American politics right now is helping kind of spread this disinformation. Because if, you know, you have an incentive to want to click and retweet and, you know, hate read this article that kind of confirms your biases or, you know, sounds like it could be correct, even without checking the facts to see if that's really accurate, right? And so essentially kind of helping that effort along.
Well, let's move to the Koreas, where North Korean leader Kim Jong-un apologized after North Korean troops shot and burned a South Korean fisheries official who was approaching the border. The incident would be the first time North Korea killed a South Korean citizen since 2008. Jennifer, what do we know about this incident?
So it's kind of confusing. You know, we have kind of conflicting reports here, but the general kind of outline of what we know is that there was a South Korean official who had essentially drifted for some reason into North Korean waters. There are conflicting reports. The North Koreans have said that he expressed a desire to defect. The official's family has denied those claims. But essentially, he was shot multiple times by North Korean sailors. And then there were initial reports that his body was then burned. The North Korean officials are now saying, no, it wasn't his body. We actually couldn't find him after the shooting, but we burned the stuff he had with him, his gear. But, you know, it was a really kind of bizarre situation. But what we saw is that this immediately was like a huge flare-up And it had the potential to potentially, you know, spin out of control. Obviously, North and South Korea have very tense relations, very sensitive relations. But President Moon Jae-in of South Korea has also been trying very hard during his presidency to try to improve relations with the North. You know, he's, you know, the son of North Korean immigrants, right? So he has a very kind of strong desire to kind of create, you know, the context for, you know, better relations. And so, you know, thankfully, we saw both sides kind of, you know, step back from the brink. And it was really stunning to see Kim Jong-un send this letter to Moon Jae-in apologizing and saying, you know, I'm very sorry for this. I'm sorry for disappointing you, President Moon, and disappointing the South Korean people. You know, this is not a leader who tends to apologize for much at all. And so it was really a kind of a symbol of just how important and how tense and how fraught North and South Korean relations are, and how much both leaders really don't want things to escalate.
Well, the U.S. no longer recognizes Alexander Lukashenko as the legitimate president of Belarus. That announcement was made by the State Department on Wednesday. This week, the past president was sworn in secret. Now, Lukashenko has clung to power with the support of Russia as protests continue. And America has joined a slew of other countries who no longer recognize the president as the legitimate leader. And that includes the U.K., its Foreign Minister Dominic Raab, who had this to say to the House of Commons on Thursday.
The world has watched, frankly, in horror at the response of the Belarusian authorities. They launched a campaign of violence, intimidation, and harassment against peaceful protesters. We've seen horrific scenes of militia attacking demonstrators and then dragging them away. UN human rights experts report that the authorities have beaten those that they held in detention, and they've threatened female protesters with violence, including rape.
Nick, some have suggested its neighbor Russia might be willing to absorb Belarus as part of a greater Russia. What's the possibility of that happening?
I think the Russia analysts I speak to say that that is unlikely, that Vladimir Putin needs to keep Belarus in the Russian orbit, but does not need to absorb it, to use your verb, to somehow, basically make it disappear. Now, there is a diplomatic maneuver that Putin could make that would essentially tie the two together more. But so far, it seems like Lukashenko's holding on, and it seems like Putin doesn't need to do what he did in eastern Ukraine and in Crimea, which is essentially invade with some conventional troops, and in Crimea, little green men, Spetsnaz special forces, to ensure that Crimea or Ukraine did not move to the West. So there are obvious tensions between the West and Putin over this, but the West has been very careful to make sure that these protests are not a repeat of Ukraine, which was looking west, which was looking to eventually join the EU and still is. This is a case where a single man has ruled for too long, according to the protesters. And then this is an internal Belarusian matter. And Lukashenko faces the largest threat to his rule. It's been 26 years. And, you know, when you get 80% of the vote, or when you claim to get 80% of the vote, and you have an inauguration in secret that was unannounced without any foreign guests, as Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the main opposition candidate, called it a farce. And another opposition candidate said Lukashenko is only the police chief of the riot police. That's what he's gone down to. So this tension on the streets will continue. It is Putin's card to play. But so far, Lukashenko is surviving without any kind of major intervention from Putin. But we will see, because it is a red line if Belarus starts moving to the West.
David, you'd assume that if Lukashenko were to lose the support of his security force, it would be game over. Why are they sticking by him?
Well, it's a country that knows how to share the proceeds of its extremely kind of state-dominated, fairly corrupt OPEC economy. And, you know, a lot of people will go down if he goes down. I don't think that many diplomats that you speak to expect some kind of pro-Western perfect Democrat to emerge if Lukashenko does step down. I think there's a kind of fairly resigned sense that someone equally unpalatable, or just a bit less brutal, might take his place, that an oligarch will be found who pleases the Kremlin, that the Kremlin effectively has a veto on this. China is also, to some extent, a player. There are only two major powers that have recognize the August election. Russia is one and China is the other. China has invested quite a lot in Belarus. China likes autocracies. They think they can deal with them. There's no messy kind of opposition parties to have to take into account. China's big infrastructure global scheme, the Belt and Road Initiative, Belarus is something of a kind of landing point for China in that part of the world. And so they would like things to be stable. And I think what you'll see, which will be sort of the way that China does this, it did this as well with Venezuela when it looked as though the regime there, the Maduro regime, might fall. China, you know, they bet big on these dictators and these autocrats because it's convenient for them, but they're pretty pragmatic. If Lukashenko falls, whoever takes over, even if they're a kind of pro-Kremlin oligarch, China will very smoothly move in there and offer money and investment, because China's interests are all that really interests China in foreign policy. But they'll certainly be supporting Lukashenko for the moment at places like the UN.
Well, Russian activist Alexei Navalny was released from a German hospital on Wednesday. He'd spent the past 32 days recovering from being poisoned with a nerve agent called Novichok. Nick, do we know what's next for Navalny?
A long recovery. His people, allies of him and friends in the Russian opposition who have talked to him, you know, tell me and tell others that he's got a long way to go. He is back on Instagram and social media, where he has created this incredible following that's able to reach into the farthest points of Russia, making acerbic jokes about himself, about his family, which has made him so popular. But he has a long recovery just because of the nature of what was done to him. Meanwhile, the Kremlin is coming after him, financially at least, once again. While he was in a medically induced coma, Russian authorities froze his assets on behalf of one of his targets, Yevgeny Prigozhin, kind of widely known here as Putin's chef, but that doesn't really get to what Prigozhin is. He's one of these oligarchs who's well-connected and well-supported by Putin and supportive of Putin, and ran the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg that did so much damage to, or at least tried to do so much damage inside the U.S. in terms of disinformation. And on Prigozhin's behalf, Navalny's assets were seized. So, you know, this is a man who has been a craw in the Kremlin for a while, and while for years Putin wouldn't even say his name, a lot of Putin's allies and people around him are being forced to talk about him because Navalny is celebrated by Europeans, European diplomats, and he's very popular among a certain generation in Russia and a certain political class in Russia. And so the Kremlin has to deal with him, and he vows to go back to Russia and continue the fight.
Well, former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster has been touring the studios to promote his book, and he's been at pains not to criticize the president, but told Jake Tapper the White House is making a fundamental mistake if it thinks it can ever trust the Kremlin.
These are people who shot down an airliner over Ukraine with incontrovertible evidence and said, we never did that. And so I think it's immensely important for us to be responsible, to pull the curtain back on their activity and not, you know, not buy in to the Russian narrative when it might be convenient to do so from a partisan political perspective.
Jennifer, very briefly, President Trump was asked specifically this week who he thought poisoned Navalny, and he said he'd talk about it, quote, at another time. Again, when it's clear who's behind the attack, why the hesitancy?
I think that's the $64,000 question. It's bizarre. It speaks to the kind of broader questions around, you know, why Trump has consistently been hesitant, you know, to criticize Putin directly. You know, the administration has done things that are more assertive vis-a-vis Russia, but Trump himself continues to kind of believe everything Putin says.
Let's get an update on the global pandemic. In Brazil, the government is allowing some football fans to return to stadiums. The country is one of the hardest hit in the world, and this is after one team reported 16 cases of coronavirus. Nick, how are people viewing the push to keep the soccer season going?
Well, I think there's a desperate desire among Brazilians, just like there are among, you know, the few of us right now, to have normalized life. Brazil, of course, though, has been hit incredibly hard. Just this week, we heard that one Brazilian city, half the population was infected. They might even have reached herd immunity, but obviously at incredible cost. As for football, as for soccer, they're going back to about 30% of stadiums, I think. You know, the main stadium, that's still 25,000 people. And as you said, this comes as the clubs, as the soccer teams, as we call them, are struggling. You know, there was another, the champion in Brazil has also has double digits of infections. But, you know, you do see some success stories that I think are questioned less around the world. New Zealand, for example, masks are no longer mandatory on public transport outside of Auckland. There's a lot of restrictions that have been lifted outside of Auckland. And yet, at the same time, we see horrific warnings out of Britain, for example, that they could go up to 50,000 cases per day next month, which would be the equivalent of a quarter of a million per day in the U.S. And Israel has just created incredible restrictions during its second lockdown. Everyone other than essential workers must work from home. People must meet outside, only 20 people, and even only then. They could have only gone 1,000 meters from their home, and synagogues would be closed for Yom Kippur. So we see these incredible struggling countries still, and everyone I speak to warns the number's going to go up as we get into the winter in the Northern Hemisphere.
Well, let's hone in on a few of the places you mentioned there, Nick. New Zealand had a cluster of outbreaks last month, but as you say, it's now experiencing a drop in cases, and the country removed its mandatory mask policy. Jennifer, just talk us through how New Zealand has been affected by the coronavirus and how they approached stopping the spread of it, or at least slowing it.
Sure. So New Zealand has been kind of this really remarkable case that the world is looking to. You know, Jacinda Ardern, the leader of New Zealand, took this very seriously and, you know, instituted very smart lockdowns, you know, mandatory mask wearing, things like that. And, you know, very early on in the pandemic, it was seen as kind of the model for how to do this. They have reduced community spread basically down to zero in most places, except for this kind of cluster in Auckland. And, you know, because of their ability to be, you know, really careful with contact tracing and with, you know, testing, widespread testing, all the kind of things that you're supposed to do as a country to kind of get this under control, you know, social distancing, things like that, they did it very well. And so they were able to actually get it under control. And because of that, life is very much starting to return to normal. Now, you know, there's also the possibility, as we've seen, you know, in Auckland with these clusters, right? There, it just takes one or two people infected to go somewhere, not follow rules, and infect a huge number of people. And it spreads very quickly, as we've seen. But I think, you know, it's really remarkable to see that in some places, you know, people like in the UK are having to kind of go back under these more severe lockdown restrictions, whereas in New Zealand, life is very much returning to normal. So I think it's just kind of a very clear example of how government policy actually matters very much in this situation, right? When it comes to coronavirus, you can have, you know, from the bottom up, you can have, you know, local areas handle things differently, but it really is a function of leadership, of setting the right example, and of doing the hard things that, well, cost money and effort, like contact tracing, like testing. And then you can actually, you know, return to a semi-normal life.
And what was the general attitude around pandemic restrictions in New Zealand?
So, you know, in general, in New Zealand, there's been, you know, a fairly strong kind of reaction in terms of, you know, accepting the social distancing and the measures needed. You know, it's also important to remember that New Zealand just fairly recently had a horrific shock to their kind of national consciousness and psyche with the massacre at Christchurch and the killing of worshippers at mosques. And, you know, very much kind of came together in solidarity. And so there's very much kind of a spirit there of, you know, we're all in this together. Let's work to, you know, to defeat this together. There has been some resistance, of course, to masks, like we've seen in the United States and other places. I get it. It's not awesome. It doesn't, you know, make your lipstick look great. But, you know, most people in general understand that it's a very important tool. And so in general, we've seen people kind of mostly follow the rules.
Oh, we heard Jennifer allude there to the fact that the UK has implemented new restrictions as cases of COVID-19 are on the rise there. Prime Minister Boris Johnson addressed the nation where he laid down the new policies, and he appealed for Britons to work from home and ordered pubs to close early.
If we follow these simple rules together, we will get through this winter together. There are unquestionably difficult months to come, and the fight against COVID is by no means over. And I have no doubt, however, that there are great days ahead. But now is the time for us all to summon the discipline and the resolve and the spirit of togetherness that will carry us through.
David, these new policies also carry tougher penalties. Can you talk us through the crackdown?
That's right. It is very strict. And you know, you heard there the tension in Boris Johnson's position, which is he knows that he has to avoid a second wave that could not just lead to, you know, these terrible numbers of new cases. We've basically had exponential growth where the numbers have been doubling every week. We've already had 42,000 deaths in the UK, which is, you know, a fifth the population of the US. So it's basically the same as 200,000 in the US. So Boris Johnson knows he has to call on the British people to be disciplined and to actually obey these rules. But you heard that language about, you know, great days are ahead. His whole kind of shtick as a politician is the guy who is the optimistic, swashbuckling, risk-taking, let's leave the European Union, let's unleash Britain's animal spirits and not worry about nanny state regulations. That was his whole pitch, which has been completely knocked aside by COVID. And so you now have this kind of libertarian conservative, Boris Johnson, saying that pubs not only have to close early, reversing a previous call for people to go back to the office and get tougher and braver and go on public transport, go to work. We now have the rule of six. Everyone's talking about in the UK that you are not allowed more than six people to gather either outdoors or indoors. So, you know, people's Christmases, you can't even have your own family to visit if it's more than six of you. There are now £10,000, it's about $12,000 fines if you break some of the rules. There's a real sense of alarm that universities are going back in England. They just went back in Scotland, and there was promptly a wave of infections. My own son starts at university in 2 days in the UK, so this is fairly personal for me sitting in China, because we don't know if they're going to stay open for very long. But this is really, we see in Britain, as we see in America and so many other places, Jen alluded to the idea of countries that are more united, like New Zealand, or you said more divided elsewhere. COVID has really been like an X-ray of all of the political pre-existing flaws and weaknesses in everyone's systems. And Britain was this kind of swashbuckling, we don't do detail, populist, rah, 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 great days are ahead, kind of Brexit Britain. And COVID has just been the most disastrous failure for this government.
Well, I want to remind folks that the Prime Minister contracted COVID earlier this year. It's a very serious case. But I'm curious, David, about sort of the mixed messaging, because not long ago, as you say, the Prime Minister was urging workers to go back to the office. Now we're seeing this switch in direction and response. How are people responding in the UK to this change of direction?
There is tremendous public frustration and extremely hostile press coverage of the, you know, it's not just that the messages change from week to week. I mean, that can happen, you know, diseases can make you change direction, but that the regulations sometimes don't simply make sense. You know, so at one point people were saying, so hang on, we're allowed to go to the pub with an unlimited number of people, but we can't have our grandmother over to sort of sit in our garden if that's three people. And, you know, there were these unbelievably convoluted rules. We've had local lockdowns. The background to all of this is that the British economy was already really rocked by having controlled things and tightened down very late by European standards. And so we took a very, very nasty early first wave, which really knocked the economy for six. Every country is worrying about the winter because that's the seasonal flu season. Are their hostels going to be overwhelmed by all of the regular things that overwhelm hostels in the winter? So you see, that really is the big explanation for the tightening now in the UK, is they're even contemplating a 2-week emergency lockdown in the middle of October, locking the whole country down just to try and avoid overwhelming hostels later in the winter. But remember, in the end of this year, all of the temporary transition arrangements fall away for Brexit, and we have the full-on effect of Brexit, which many people believe is going to be very, very risky for the British economy. So Britain, this little buccaneering island under Boris Johnson, is taking so many risks, one on top of the other, economic, political, Brexit, worrying about the second wave. It is a very scary time in the UK.
The European Union has a new migration pact. Its leaders say it'll put an end to the appalling camps, like the ones destroyed by the fire on the Greek island of Lesbos. This new strategy was announced on Wednesday, and the EU's Home Affairs Chief, Jelle Johansen, said Europe had a responsibility to do better.
Migrants are like you and I. They are men and women, boys and girls. They have different opinions, they have different experience, and they are human beings, and they have to be treated like that.
That was Jelle Johansen, Home Affairs Chief for the EU. Jennifer, tell us more about this new pact.
Sure. So this is essentially being kind of billed as the fresh start or a new plan, a new way to address the, you know, the kind of asylum, refugee, migrant crisis. If you remember, you know, roughly 5 years ago, we saw it was really the height of this crisis, you know, a million migrants coming to Europe, primarily from places like Syria and Afghanistan, fleeing, you know, war-torn areas. And, you know, it kind of created this huge crisis for Europe to deal with. And there were kind of quotas that were put in place saying that each country needs to take, you know, should take X amount of refugees into their country. A lot of countries just completely ignored that. Since then, the crisis has, you know, diminished greatly. I think last year, something like 140,000 people requested asylum. So we're not talking nearly the kind of numbers, but there's still, you know, a very real issue. And so, you know, this new plan, which is backed by Germany, would essentially require all 27 member countries in the EU to participate. And essentially, the states would agree to take in asylum seekers or take responsibility for sending them back, the ones who are denied asylum. It sets up like basically an expedited process for processing and particularly for deporting those who are denied asylum. It also includes, you know, cash incentives. You get X amount of money. It's roughly around 10,000 euros, so around $11,700 for each refugee you accept to cover things like the cost of travel, housing, things like that. But it's very much focused on returning refugees. And it's you know, if we think about these camps and the camp, like you mentioned, the fire and the island of Lesbos, you know, we have these kind of camps that are still existing. And so rather than having kind of a slower process, you know, just kind of leaving people to kind of linger, it's very much focused on returning people back to their home countries. Now, there's a problem with that. There are several problems. One of the main problems is that a lot of these countries will usually refuse to take these people back, and there's nothing that the EU can really do about that. And so, you know, and then the second problem is that a lot of, you know, the countries who have borne a lot of the burden, you know, early on in taking these refugees are still refusing to kind of do anything more than they already have.
Well, Nick, you have hardliners in the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary. How likely is it that the EU can unify around such a divisive issue?
I think most analysts say unlikely. I think that's your one-word answer. It's unlikely that money or European Union plans that Jen just went through for quicker processing, for example, will convince people in Poland and Hungary are two of the resistors, I suppose you could call them. You know, and the EU Home Affairs Commissioner says no one will be satisfied with these measures. And when she says that, you know, she is acknowledging that she has to weigh politics with the humanitarian duty of the bloc that for fate of geography has to deal with so many of these migrants who are moving forward. And as Jen points out, it is lower than it used to be in terms of the numbers. But this is a crisis. There is no doubt. A crisis that's been running for years. The Lesbos fire just highlights that. And when it comes to Germany and Merkel, I think she's not only trying to find a solution to that long-running crisis, but also probably cement a political legacy as she looks toward the end of her term.
Well, since returning to the United States, Meghan Markle has used her celebrity to talk about the importance of voting in November. This week, her husband joined that conversation, which has not amused the president or the palace. Here's what Prince Henry had to say.
This election, I'm not going to be able to vote here in the US. But many of you may not know that I haven't been able to vote in the UK my entire life. As we approach this November, it's vital that we reject hate speech, misinformation, and online negativity.
I misspoke. I said Prince Henry instead of Prince Harry. But David, this is not what you would call controversial. So really quickly, why are so many feathers being ruffled here?
Well, the royal family is very cautious in the UK. They're not meant to get involved in politics. And in an election as divisive as yours in America, you know, if you seem to be signaling that you're telling people not to vote for Donald Trump, which I think how some people are reading this, then the half of the country that is planning to vote for Donald Trump, roughly, is going to get upset. And we saw President Trump asked about this by a reporter and saying that he's not a fan of Prince Harry's wife, Meghan Markle, and he wished him a lot of luck in a fairly sardonic way because he's going to need it. So this is the sort of palace's fear, is that once they're out of the kind of the palace machine and living in the States, they're going to be exposed to this kind of controversy that other royals are very deliberately kept away from.
That's David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist, Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor at Vox, and Nick Schifrin, correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks to you all. 1A senior producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer. Matthew Simonson produces our podcast. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.